You are listening to History Man, a project of ekbarnes.com, where we walk in the footsteps of heroes and proclaim freedom reigns. On this episode, we are with Durant Ashmore again, talking about the history of Lawrence County in the Revolutionary War, some of the events leading up to that. So welcome again, Durant.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate it.
So in our last episode, we talked a little bit about the Regulator movement, and then we got into some of the struggles with the Cherokee here in the backcountry of South Carolina leading up to the Revolutionary War. Let's continue on that topic. Tell me a little bit more about the Cherokee.
Well, you know, the relationship of the backcountry settlers to the Cherokees was the overriding concern in this area. Yes, we know all about, you know, the British and taxation without representation and that sort of thing, but the backcountry settlers during this time period, from 1755 to 1777, this was the frontier of America. In 1755, the Treaty of Saluda gave this area, which is the 96th district, to open it up for European expansion. And during that treaty, the agreement was that this 8 present-day counties in South Carolina would be sold by the Cherokees for an annual shipment of shot and powder every fall to the Cherokees so that they could have their fall hunt and provide, at the same time, deer skins and medicinal plants to the colonial authorities for trade. It was somewhat of a love-hate relationship because both parties benefited from each other, but both parties, the Cherokees and the settlers, also suffered from each other. So key to what was happening in the backcountry, part of this has to do with Cherokee culture versus European culture. These were two cultures that could not understand each other. Their thinking was diametrically opposed in so many ways. Things that made perfect sense to Europeans made absolutely no sense whatsoever to the Cherokees.
Give me an example.
Well, an example of that is what started the first Cherokee War in the first place, the Anglo-Cherokee War. This was a subset of the French and Indian War. The Anglo-Cherokee War started in 1758 to 1762. The Cherokees are a clan-based society. They are a matrilineal society. You belong to the clan of your mother. Clan law regulated Cherokee society for centuries. There were 7 clans in the Cherokees, the Paint clan, the Wolf clan, the Bird clan, and so forth. You belong to the clan of your mother. And what that meant was that fathers did not raise their children. Now imagine a European thinking fathers do not raise their children, but they did not. The obligation of a Cherokee maiden was to strengthen the clan. Her duty was to have the strongest clan possible. And by doing that, the way she did that was to choose who the father of her children was going to be. Based on his physical attributes, he could be the worst drunk there ever was, but he was a fine, strapping man. She would want to become his wife. And also a Cherokee woman, at any time that she wanted to, she could divorce her husband with a simple flick of her wrist. It did not matter. The father was not going to raise her children. Her brothers raised her children in the ways of the clan. So clan society regulated the Cherokees. And what that meant was there were really few transgressions that could be committed among the Cherokees. Like, they didn't have stealing. They didn't have own private property, so you didn't have to worry about stealing. That's another way that the Europeans couldn't understand what the Cherokees were doing.
The huge, I mean, that right there has always been something that I've seen as one of the biggest obstacles for that understanding, was the ownership of property.
Private property, right. Yeah. The Cherokees had no concept of private property until horses came into play.
And then even later, when they had went on the Trail of Tears, they didn't. The ones who stayed in North Carolina were the ones who actually bought their property. They finally made a turn in their mind and said, "We're going to have private ownership of that," and they bought up their property. That's interesting.
But one of the transgressions that were, you know, regulated in Cherokee society was murder. So if one clansman killed another clansman, then their system was based on an eye for an eye. If one clansman killed another clansman, then that clan had the right to kill the perpetrator. So if a member of the Paint clan killed a member of the Wolf clan, then the Wolf clan had the right to kill that member of the Paint clan or any other member of the Paint clan of equal right. Did not necessarily have to be the perpetrator, but the Wolf clan had that right. So what happened if a fellow from the Paint clan killed a member from the Wolf clan, and then the killer left and went down to Florida? Well, the Wolf clan had the right to kill any member of the Paint clan of equal right. So that killer left going down to Florida knowing that one of his clan members was going to get killed in his place. And so this is what led to really the first Cherokee War, when the Cherokees, who were British allies fighting in Fort Duquesne, French and Indian War, the Cherokees under Richard Parris went the overland route at Fort Duquesne and captured that fort. Now, Fort Duquesne was where modern-day Pittsburgh is, and it defended the rivers, Allegheny, Monongahela, and Ohio River. It was a chokehold on those rivers, but it could not be defended by land. So the Cherokees took over and were able to capture Fort Duquesne, a great British victory. Now, stories vary. Either they were promised 30 horses by the governor of Virginia, or 30 of their horses were stolen by Virginians, and the Cherokees were left to walk home without their horses. Well, eye for an eye, as they were walking through North Carolina, they started asking people, "What clan did the people belong to that stole our horses?" And the reply was, "Clan? We ain't got no stinking clans. We're all one clan." So to the Cherokee mind, one clan stole their horses. All they had to do, eye for an eye, was take 30 horses and head on back to the mountains of South Carolina. Well, the people in North Carolina, they really don't take too kindly to horse thieves. And there was fighting all the way back. And 20-some-odd North Carolinians were killed during that trek back to the mountains of South Carolina. One thing led to another, but this is what started the Anglo-Cherokee War and the first war of the Cherokees. And thoughts like that continued on through up until the Revolution. And there were just tremendous conflicts with the Cherokees. On top of that, there were other tribes, Shawnees from Ohio, Creeks from Georgia, Europeans dressed up as Cherokees that were coming through the backcountry of South Carolina. Anytime these people stole a horse, took a scalp, whatever it was that they did, the Cherokees got blamed for that. And as a result, there was just tremendous animosity all the way through.
That is phenomenal and a great encapsulation of kind of the environment that people lived here on the back country here in Lawrence, all the way up to Cherokee County, Spartanburg County, that area
right
there.
Right, it was
right
it
on
was
the edge of the Cherokee Nations. These were the lower towns, right? They were
That's
lower,
right.
middle,
yeah.
and upper towns. And the upper towns were up in the mountains, the middle. And tell me how that worked out. The
well,
lower towns were in South Carolina.
Yeah,
just on
there
this
were
side
16.
Of the
so all along the western North Carolina, Greenville, Anderson, Spartanburg, and Oconee counties were Cherokee territory. Up until 1777. And this area, it was defining that territory was a convoluted situation as well. But there were 16 lower town Cherokee towns in Oconee and Pickens County. Greenville County and Anderson County were Cherokee hunting grounds. There weren't any established towns at that point. The middle towns were around Franklin, North Carolina, and then the Overhill towns were in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
So all three groupings had the seven different clans. They spoke somewhat different dialects. They were separate in that regard. The problem with that and all of these treaties that were made, and there were so many treaties that were made in this area, the Treaty of Hard Labor, the Treaty of Lochaber, all trying to define what areas the Cherokees could be in and what areas the Europeans could be in. But there was no real central government with the Cherokees, and there was very little central government with the Europeans. So if the South Carolinians made a treaty with the lower town Cherokees, the Overhill Cherokees weren't bound by that. The settlers in Tennessee weren't bound by that. And so it just is another source of conflict
right.
throughout the entire setting.
And indeed, you had some of the upper Cherokees would come across the middle Cherokees and the lower Cherokees and make raids on the settlers and go back.
Yes.
And the lower Cherokees had no idea. Right?
Exactly, exactly. So it just, you know, was a real confusing situation. The concern at the beginning of the Revolutionary War in the back country was not with the British, it was with the Cherokees. You know, it's important to realize that there were two different periods in the Revolutionary War in South Carolina. The first period from 1775 to 1780 was the American period. There were no British troops in South Carolina during that time except for a excursion from Savannah in 1779 towards Charleston, which was repulsed. But there were not British troops in South Carolina for the first 5 years of the Revolutionary War. Now, after Charleston fell, May the 12th, 1780, the world was turned upside down and everything changed then. But the first 5 years of the war had to do with the relationship with the Cherokees. You have the Snow Campaign, which was the first shots ever fired south of Lexington and Concord. Lexington and Concord was in March of 1775. In November of 1775, a Loyalist captain here, Patrick Cunningham, his brother, Robert Cunningham, and these are Lawrence County folks, Little River District folks, the leading Loyalist in the state of South Carolina was Robert Cunningham, General Robert Cunningham, from the Little River District. He lived at the Newberry-Lawrence County border. His plantation, Peach Hill, is now under Lake Greenwood. He was captured by the Council of Safety because he was raising so much heck up here. And they put him in a dungeon in Charleston along with Richard Paris, who was another Loyalist. Patrick Cunningham, his brother, he got the idea that he was going to take 200 men down to Charleston and free his brother. That was an unrealistic thought. But on his way down to Charleston, he ran across that shipment of shot and powder that was being delivered to the Cherokees. Now, at this point, the Council of Safety was sending that shipment because they wanted to curry the favor of the Cherokees. But Patrick Cunningham at Mine Creek, 18 miles below 96, he captured that shot and powder, and he wanted to keep it for the Loyalist forces, and he did not want the Cherokees to become allies with the Patriots. So this led to a standoff, the first siege at 96. Patrick Cunningham with 200 men. He quickly gets surrounded by Andrew Williamson, who was the leading Patriot in the area, with a force of 450 men. Well, the Loyalists were able to raise a force of 1,900 men to besiege Williamson in 96. And this is all happening, you know, very quickly. 200 Loyalists, 450 Patriots, 1,900 Loyalists. Now, Richard Richardson from the Camden District is raising a force of South Carolina Patriots and North Carolina Patriots as well. 4,500 men, an army of 4,500 men comes in to relieve the siege at 96. And a truce was arranged where everybody would go home and make nice, even though shots had been fired and people had been killed in the first siege of 96. But when Richard Richardson got into this area, he did not abide by the terms of that truce. He felt like it didn't apply to him. And he went after Patrick Cunningham and his 200 men who had captured the powder and shot intended for the Cherokees. Now, Patrick Cunningham, when the siege at 96 was broken, he went to the wildest, most remote place he could possibly find. And that was a canebrake along the Reedy River in what is now southern Greenville County, which was Cherokee territory. And he was encamped there. And when Richard Richardson got word of where Patrick Cunningham was, he sent a flying column overnight led by Major William Danger Thompson with 1,300 men to surround Patrick Cunningham. And right before the encirclement occurred, shots rang out. The Tories realized that they were under attack. 70 of them jumped on horses and rode up the Reedy to escape into Cherokee territory. 130 were captured. This is the Battle of the Great Canebrake. The canebrake was a defensive structure that the Cherokees utilized throughout time because you can't sneak up on somebody in a canebrake. The rustling leaves make too much noise. But those men were had their hands bound behind their back after the 15-minute battle was over. And as soon as they had their hands tied, it was bitter cold. It was December 22nd, 1775, and it started snowing. And it started snowing like the backcountry had never seen snow before, or really since. They had 18 inches of snow as those men were marched down to Charleston in captivity. Many of the men did not even have shoes. There were bloody footprints in the snow. And that was the snow campaign, which really quelled Loyalist sentiment in the backcountry. The backcountry was divided, 50% Loyalists, 50% Patriots. But due to the actions of the snow campaign, the Loyalist leaders were either captured or sent in exile. They went down to Florida. Some of them went up to New York and joined the British forces there. But basically, the backcountry became Patriot because the Loyalist leaders were rounded up or driven away.
We talked about the Regulator movement in the last episode. Robert Cunningham, mm-hmm. was he a recipient of good graces from the Regulator movement?
Well,
didn't he become a judge or something?
Well, he was a Justice of the Peace.
Justice of the Peace as
right.
a result of that. When they set up courts,
right,
he became
right.
a Justice of the Peace.
But it's... It was not divided. You can't say that the Regulators were Loyalist or Moderators were this or that. It was all mixed in the
right.
same way in North Carolina as well.
Right, right.
After the Regulator movement, and he became a Justice of the Peace, Robert Cunningham was the second wealthiest man in the Lawrence District. The wealthiest man was his brother Patrick, These were two of the leading men. The wealthiest man of all in the backcountry, or in the 96th district, was Charles Moore, who built Walnut Grove Plantation.
Right, right.
Now, Charles Moore was awarded, he had 3,500 acres. He was the biggest landowner. But he became a patriot. He was a justice of the peace as well in the 96th district. But again, he became a patriot. Two other very wealthy loyalists were Robert and Patrick Cunningham. Patrick Cunningham had 40 slaves. He was probably the largest slaveholder in the area. One of the leading regulators was Thomas Fletchall in Fairforest, Union County.
And he became a British loyalist.
He did. Yeah. He was captured during the Snow Campaign. He was found hiding in a hollow log. But Thomas Fletchall was 56 years old and weighed 300 pounds.
Big man.
He was a big man. And after he was captured and he was marched down to Charleston, he just basically gave up. He was like, you know, I'm too old, I'm too big to fight. So he wasn't a factor much mm-hmm. later on. Mm-hmm. But
well, just out of your research, why did Patrick Cunningham, Robert Cunningham, Fletchall, why did they choose the loyalist when others chose the patriot side?
Yes.
What was the difference?
It was the Cherokees. Who was going to give better protection from the Cherokees? And if you thought that the British government could give you better protection of the Cherokees, then you were a loyalist. If you thought the British government had neglected the backcountry for decades the way they had, you were a patriot. The British, you know, 1730, they made a law that there would never be expansion beyond the Appalachian Mountains. Well, if you wanted to expand beyond the Appalachian Mountains here in the backcountry, you became a patriot. And but there were so many other factors as well. Jealousy. You know, if you hated your neighbor and he became a loyalist, well, you're going to be a patriot because, you know, you want to take up arms against that guy.
Sure, sure. Nathaniel Greene even talked about the civil war that really erupted in South Carolina prior to him getting here.
It was an absolute civil war. The first colonel that was elected in the backcountry, you know, there was three people vying for this job, and one of them was Robert Cunningham as a colonel under the Council of Safety. Another one was Moses Kirkland, who was a leading loyalist who left the area and became a British provincial in New York before he came back. The third contender was James Mason, M-A-Y-S-O-N. And James Mason was awarded the colonelcy over those other two. And Robert Cunningham wanted that position. Well, when he didn't get it, he became a loyalist, and he became the leading loyalist. And when Moses Kirkland didn't get it, he left and went to New York. Now, James Mason turned to be out to be, I mean, he was a good man, but he hardly did anything afterwards. He led the attack on Fort Charlotte, which was the first armed incident in South Carolina. The British had stored all their backcountry powder and ammunition and swivel guns and things like that at Fort Charlotte.
Which is on the Savannah River.
And it's currently underwater
right
now. The fort was lightly defended, and the defender of the fort, you know, his family was there. He just turned the fort over immediately. But that's, you know, where the Patriots got a lot of shot and gunpowder and things like that. But over those conflicts, you know, Mason remained a patriot, Cunningham and Kirkland became loyalists. Andrew Pickens later on said that Robert Cunningham should have been given that colonelcy. He was the most qualified man of all. And if he had of, who knows how things would have changed then.
Looking forward to our next episode, if you'll stick around with us. This is fascinating. I'm on the edge of my seat, and I'm sure the listeners are too. Real quickly, tell me a little bit about some events coming up here soon.
Well, on July the 20th, I'm going to be giving a talk here at the museum, 7 o'clock in the evening, on Lawrence County heroes, villains, and heroines. And I'm telling you, folks, some of the leading Revolutionary War figures resided here in Lawrence County. Now, I'm not saying that they were patriot heroes by any means. The biggest loyalist in the state of South Carolina, Robert Cunningham, resided here, and the biggest loyalist in the state of North Carolina lived here, and that's Colonel David Fanning. He is a story in and of himself. And Lawrence County is famous for its heroines, such as Dicey Langston, who we'll learn all about, and Pamela Cunningham, who is the granddaughter of Patrick Cunningham, who I've spoken of here. And Pamela Cunningham is the lady who saved Mount Vernon from destruction. She started the Mount Vernon Ladies Association in the 1850s. The granddaughter of the Loyalist captain, Patrick Cunningham, saved George Washington's mansion. And she's right here from Lawrence County.
And that is when?
That's July the 20th at 7 o'clock here at the Lawrence County Museum.
And how would they reach Lawrence County Museum? And
Lawrence County Museum website. That's lawrencecountymuseum.org. The phone number is 864-683-3678. And it's also on Facebook.
Very good.